This is Audible.
Into Thin Air by John Krakauer. Copyright 1997 by John Krakauer. This recording of the full-length reading of Into Thin Air was published by arrangement with Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing, a division of Bantam Doubleday Dell Publishing Group, Incorporated, and was produced in 1997 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by Philip Franklin. Into Thin Air, A Personal Account of the Mount Everest Disaster, by John Krakauer. This book consists of 21 chapters and is 288 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. When John Krakauer reached the summit of Mount Everest in the early afternoon of May 10, 1996, he hadn't slept in 57 hours and was reeling from the brain-altering effects of oxygen depletion. As he turned to begin his long, dangerous descent from 29,028 feet, 20 other climbers were still pushing doggedly toward the top. No one had noticed that the sky had begun to fill with clouds. 6 hours later, and 3,000 feet lower, in 70-knot winds and blinding snow, Krakauer collapsed in his tent, freezing, hallucinating from exhaustion and hypoxia, but safe. The following morning, he learned that 6 of his fellow climbers hadn't made it back to their camp and were in a desperate struggle for their lives. When the storm finally passed, 5 of them would be dead, and the 6th, so horribly frostbitten that his right hand would have to be amputated. Into Thin Air is the definitive account of the deadliest season in the history of Everest by the acclaimed journalist and author of the bestseller Into the Wild. On assignment for Outside Magazine to report on the growing commercialization of the mountain, Krakauer, an accomplished climber, went to the Himalaya as a client of Rob Hall, the most respected high-altitude guide in the world. A rangy 35-year-old New Zealander, Hall had summited Everest 4 times between 1990 and 1995 and led 39 climbers to the top. Ascending the mountain in close proximity to Hall's team was a guided expedition led by Scott Fisher, a 40-year-old American with legendary strength and drive who had climbed the peak without supplemental oxygen in 1994. But neither Hall nor Fisher survived the rogue storm that struck in May 1996. Krakauer examines what it is about Everest that has compelled so many people, including himself, to throw caution to the wind, ignore the concerns of loved ones, and willingly subject themselves to such risk, hardship, and expense. Written with emotional clarity and supported by his unimpeachable reporting, Krakauer's eyewitness account of what happened on the roof of the world is a singular achievement. John Krakauer, author of 3 books, including the acclaimed bestseller Into the Wild, is a contributing editor of Outside Magazine. He and his wife live in Seattle. For Linda, and in memory of Andy Harris, Doug Hansen, Rob Hall, Yasko Namba, Scott Fisher, Gawang Topche Sherpa, Chen Yu Nan, Bruce Harrod, and Lobsang Jangbu Sherpa. Men play at tragedy because they do not believe in the reality of the tragedy which is actually being staged in the civilized world. Jose Ortega y Gasset. Introduction. In March 1996, Outside Magazine sent me to Nepal to participate in and write about a guided ascent of Mount Everest. I went as one of 8 clients on an expedition led by a well-known guide from New Zealand named Rob Hall. On May 10th, I arrived on top of the mountain, but the summit came at a terrible cost. Among my 5 teammates who reached the top, 4, including Hall, perished in a rogue storm that blew in without warning while we were still high on the peak. By the time I'd descended to base camp, 9 climbers from 4 expeditions were dead, and 3 more lives would be lost before the month was out. The expedition left me badly shaken, and the article was difficult to write. Nevertheless, 5 weeks after I returned from Nepal, I delivered a manuscript to Outside, and it was published in the September issue of the magazine. Upon its completion, I attempted to put Everest out of my mind and get on with my life, but that turned out to be impossible. Through a fog of messy emotions, I continued trying to make sense of what had happened up there, and I obsessively mulled the circumstances of my companions' deaths. The Outside piece was as accurate as I could make it under the circumstances, but my deadline had been unforgiving, the sequence of events had been frustratingly complex, and the memories of the survivors had been badly distorted by exhaustion, oxygen depletion, and shock. At one point during my research, I asked three other people to recount an incident all four of us had witnessed high on the mountain. And none of us could agree on such crucial facts as the time, what had been said, or even who had been present. Within days after the Outside article went to press, I discovered that a few of the details I'd reported were an error. Most were minor inaccuracies of the sort that inevitably creep into works of deadline journalism. But one of my blunders was in no sense minor, and it had a devastating impact on the friends and family of one of the victims. Only slightly less disconcerting than the article's factual errors was the material that necessarily had to be omitted for lack of space. Mark Bryant, the editor of Outside, and Larry Burke, the publisher, had given me an extraordinary amount of room to tell the story. They ran the piece at 17,000 words, 4 or 5 times as long as a typical magazine feature. Even so, I felt that it was much too abbreviated to do justice to the tragedy. The Everest climb had rocked my life to its core, and it became desperately important for me to record the events in complete detail, unconstrained by a limited number of column inches. This book is the fruit of that compulsion. The staggering unreliability of the human mind at high altitude made the research problematic. To avoid relying excessively on my own perceptions, I interviewed most of the protagonists at great length and on multiple occasions. When possible, I also corroborated details with radio logs maintained by people at base camp, where clear thought wasn't in such short supply. Readers familiar with the Outside article may notice discrepancies between certain details, primarily matters of time, reported in the magazine and those reported in the book. The revisions reflect new information that has come to light since publication of the magazine piece. Several authors and editors I respect counseled me not to write the book as quickly as I did. They urged me to wait 2 or 3 years and put some distance between me and the expedition in order to gain some crucial perspective. Their advice was sound, but in the end, I ignored it, mostly because what happened on the mountain was gnawing my guts out. I thought that writing the book might purge Everest from my life. It hasn't, of course. Moreover, I agree that readers are often poorly served when an author writes as an act of catharsis, as I have done here. But I hoped something would be gained by spilling my soul in the calamity's immediate aftermath, in the roil and torment of the moment. I wanted my account to have a raw, ruthless sort of honesty that seemed in danger of leaching away with the passage of time and the dissipation of anguish. Some of the same people who warned me against writing hastily had also cautioned me against going to Everest in the first place. There were many, many fine reasons not to go. But attempting to climb Everest is an intrinsically irrational act, a triumph of desire over sensibility. Any person who would seriously consider it is almost by definition beyond the sway of reasoned argument. The plain truth is that I knew better, but went to Everest anyway. And in doing so, I was a party to the death of good people, which is something that is apt to remain on my conscience for a very long time. John Krakauer, Seattle, November 1996. Chapter 1. Everest Summit, May 10th, 1996. 29,028 feet. It would seem almost as though there were a cordon drawn round the upper part of these great peaks beyond which no man may go. The truth, of course, lies in the fact that, At altitudes of 25,000 feet and beyond, the effects of low atmospheric pressure upon the human body are so severe that really difficult mountaineering is impossible, and the consequences even of a mild storm may be deadly, that nothing but the most perfect conditions of weather and snow offers the slightest chance of success, and that on the last lap of the climb, no party is in a position to choose its day. No, it is not remarkable that Everest did not yield to the first few attempts. Indeed, it would have been very surprising and not a little sad if it had, for that is not the way of great mountains. Perhaps we had become a little arrogant with our fine new technique of ice claw and rubber slipper, our age of easy mechanical conquest. We had forgotten that the mountain still holds the master card, that it will grant success only in its own good time. Why else does mountaineering retain its deep fascination? Eric Shipton, in 1938, Upon That Mountain. Straddling the top of the world, one foot in China and the other in Nepal, I cleared the ice from my oxygen mask, hunched a shoulder against the wind, and stared absently down at the vastness of Tibet. I understood on some dim, detached level that the sweep of earth beneath my feet was a spectacular sight. I'd been fantasizing about this moment, and the release of emotion that would accompany it, for many months. But now that I was finally here, actually standing on the summit of Mount Everest, I just couldn't summon the energy to care. It was early in the afternoon of May 10th, 1996. I hadn't slept in 57 hours. The only food I'd been able to force down over the preceding 3 days was a bowl of ramen soup and a handful of peanut M&Ms. Weeks of violent coughing had left me with two separated ribs that made ordinary breathing an excruciating trial. At 29,028 feet up in the troposphere, so little oxygen was reaching my brain that my mental capacity was that of a slow child. Under the circumstances, I was incapable of feeling much of anything except cold and tired. I'd arrived on the summit a few minutes after Anatoly Bukharev, a Russian climbing guide working for an American commercial expedition, and just ahead of Andy Harris, a guide on the New Zealand-based team to which I belonged. Although I was only slightly acquainted with Bukharev, I'd come to know and like Harris well during the preceding 6 weeks. I snapped four quick photos of Harris and Bukharev striking summit poses, then turned and headed down. My watch read 1:17 p.m. All told, I'd spent less than 5 minutes on the roof of the world. A moment later, I paused to take another photo, this one looking down the southeast ridge, the route we had ascended. Training my lens on a pair of climbers approaching the summit, I noticed something that until that moment had escaped my attention. To the south, where the sky had been perfectly clear just an hour earlier, a blanket of clouds now hid Pumori, Ama Da Blam, and the other lesser peaks surrounding Everest. Later, after 6 bodies had been located, after a search for 2 others had been abandoned, after surgeons had amputated the gangrenous right hand of my teammate, Beck Weathers, people would ask why, if the weather had begun to deteriorate, had climbers on the upper mountain not heeded the signs? Why did veteran Himalayan guides keep moving upward, ushering a gaggle of relatively inexperienced amateurs, each of whom had paid as much as $65,000 to be taken safely up Everest, into an apparent death trap? Nobody can speak for the leaders of the 2 guided groups involved, because both men are dead. But I can attest that nothing I saw early on the afternoon of May 10th suggested that a murderous storm was bearing down. To my oxygen-depleted mind, the clouds drifting up the grand valley of ice known as the Western Coombe looked innocuous, wispy, insubstantial. Note: the Western Coombe was named by George Lee Mallory, who first saw it during the initial Everest expedition of 1921 from the Low La, a high pass on the border between Nepal and Tibet. Coombe is a Welsh term for valley or cirque. End of note. Gleaming in the brilliant midday sun, they appeared no different from the harmless puffs of convection condensation that rose from the valley almost every afternoon. As I began my descent, I was extremely anxious, but my concern had little to do with the weather. A check of the gauge on my oxygen tank had revealed that it was almost empty. I needed to get down, fast. The uppermost shank of Everest's southeast ridge is a slender, heavily corniced fin of rock and wind-scoured snow that snakes for a quarter mile between the summit and a subordinate pinnacle known as the South Summit. Negotiating the serrated ridge presents no great technical hurdles, but the route is dreadfully exposed. After leaving the summit, 15 minutes of cautious shuffling over a 7,000-foot abyss brought me to the notorious Hillary Step, a pronounced notch in the ridge that demands some technical maneuvering. As I clipped into a fixed rope and prepared to rappel over the lip, I was greeted with an alarming sight. 30 feet below, more than a dozen people were queued up at the base of the step. 3 climbers were already in the process of hauling themselves up the rope that I was preparing to descend. Exercising my only option, I unclipped from the communal safety line and stepped aside. The traffic jam was comprised of climbers from 3 expeditions. The team I belonged to, a group of paying clients under the leadership of the celebrated New Zealand guide Rob Hall, another guided party headed by the American Scott Fisher, and a non-commercial Taiwanese team. Moving at the snail's pace that is the norm above 26,000 feet, the throng labored up the Hillary Step one by one, while I nervously bided my time. Harris, who'd left the summit shortly after I did, soon pulled up behind me. Wanting to conserve whatever oxygen remained in my tank, I asked him to reach inside my backpack and turn off the valve on my regulator, which he did. For the next 10 minutes I felt surprisingly good. My head cleared. I actually seemed less tired than I had with the gas turned on. Then, abruptly, I sensed that I was suffocating. My vision dimmed and my head began to spin. I was on the brink of losing consciousness. Instead of turning my oxygen off, Harris, in his hypoxically impaired state, had mistakenly cranked the valve open to full flow, draining the tank. I'd just squandered the last of my gas going nowhere. There was another tank waiting for me at the South Summit, 250 feet below, but to get there, I would have to descend the most exposed terrain on the entire route without the benefit of supplemental oxygen. And first, I had to wait for the mob to disperse. I removed my now useless mask, planted my ice axe into the mountain's frozen hide, and hunkered on the ridge. As I exchanged banal congratulations with the climbers filing past, inwardly I was frantic. Hurry it up, I silently pleaded. While you guys are fucking around here, I'm losing brain cells by the millions. Most of the passing crowd belonged to Fisher's group, but near the back of the parade, 2 of my teammates eventually appeared. Rob Hall and Yasko Namba. Demure and reserved, the 47-year-old Namba was 40 minutes away from becoming the oldest woman to climb Everest and the 2nd Japanese woman to reach the highest point on each continent, the so-called 7 summits. Although she weighed just 91 pounds, her sparrow-like proportions disguised a formidable resolve. To an astounding degree, Yasko had been propelled up the mountain by the unwavering intensity of her desire. Later still, Doug Hansen arrived atop the step. Another member of our expedition, Doug was a postal worker from a Seattle suburb who'd become my closest friend on the mountain. "It's in the bag!" I yelled over the wind, trying to sound more upbeat than I felt. Exhausted, Doug mumbled something from behind his oxygen mask that I didn't catch, shook my hand weakly, then continued plodding upward. At the very end of the line was Scott Fisher, whom I knew casually from Seattle, where we both lived. Fisher's strength and drive were legendary. In 1994, he'd climbed Everest without using bottled oxygen, so I was surprised at how slowly he was moving and how hammered he looked when he pulled his mask aside to say hello. "Bruce!" he wheezed with forced cheer, employing his trademark frat boyish greeting. When I asked how he was doing, Fisher insisted that he was feeling fine. "Just dragging ass a little today, for some reason. No big deal." With the Hillary Step finally clear, I clipped into the strand of orange rope, swung quickly around Fisher as he slumped over his ice axe, and rappelled over the edge. It was after 3 o'clock when I made it down to the south summit. By now, tendrils of mist were streaming over the 27,923-foot top of Lhotse and lapping at Everest's summit pyramid. No longer did the weather look so benign. I grabbed a fresh oxygen cylinder, jammed it onto my regulator, and hurried down into the gathering cloud. Moments after I dropped below the south summit, it began to snow lightly, and visibility went to hell. 400 vertical feet above, where the summit was still washed in bright sunlight under an immaculate cobalt sky, my compadres dallied to memorialize their arrival at the apex of the planet, unfurling flags and snapping photos, using up precious ticks of the clock. None of them imagined that a horrible ordeal was drawing nigh. Nobody suspected that by the end of that long day, every minute would matter. Chapter 2. Dehradun, India, 1852. 2,234 feet. Far from the mountains in winter, I discovered the blurred photo of Everest in Richard Halliburton's Book of Marvels. It was a miserable reproduction in which the jagged peaks rose white against a grotesquely blackened and scratched sky. Everest itself, sitting back from the front ones, didn't even appear highest, but it didn't matter. It was. The legend said so. Dreams were the key to the picture, permitting a boy to enter it, to stand at the crest of the wind-swept ridge, to climb toward the summit, now no longer far above. This was one of those uninhibited dreams that come free with growing up. I was sure that mine about Everest was not mine alone. The highest point on earth, unattainable, foreign to all experience, was there for many boys and grown men to aspire toward. Thomas F. Hornbein, Everest, the West Ridge. The actual particulars of the event are unclear, obscured by the accretion of myth. But the year was 1852, and the setting was the offices of the Great Trigonometrical Survey of India in the northern hill station of Dehradun. According to the most plausible version of what transpired, a clerk rushed into the chambers of Sir Andrew Wall, India's Surveyor General, and exclaimed that a Bengali computer named Radhanath Sikdar, working out of the Survey's Calcutta Bureau, had discovered the highest mountain in the world. In Waugh's day, a computer was a job description rather than a machine. Designated Peak 15 by surveyors in the field who'd first measured the angle of its rise with a 24-inch theodolite 3 years earlier, the mountain in question jutted from the spine of the Himalaya in the forbidden kingdom of Nepal. Until Sikdar compiled the survey data and did the math, nobody had suspected that there was anything noteworthy about Peak 15. The 6 survey sites from which the summit had been triangulated were in northern India, more than 100 miles from the mountain. To the surveyors who shot it, all but the summit nub of Peak 15 was obscured by various high escarpments in the foreground, several of which gave the illusion of being much greater in stature. But according to Sikdar's meticulous trigonometric reckoning, which took into account such factors as curvature of the earth, atmospheric refraction, and plumb line deflection, Peak 15 stood 29,002 feet above sea level, the planet's loftiest point. Note: modern surveys using lasers and state-of-the-art Doppler satellite transmissions have revised this measurement upward a mere 26 feet to the currently accepted altitude of 29,028 feet, or 8,848 meters. End of note. In 1865, 9 years after Sikdar's computations had been confirmed, Waugh bestowed the name Mount Everest on Peak 15 in honor of Sir George Everest, his predecessor as Surveyor General. As it happened, Tibetans who lived to the north of the great mountain already had a more mellifluous name for it, Jomo Lungma, which translates to Goddess, Mother of the World, and Nepalis who resided to the south called the peak Sagarmatha, Goddess of the Sky. But Waugh pointedly chose to ignore these native appellations, as well as official policy encouraging the retention of local or ancient names, and Everest was the name that stuck. Once Everest was determined to be the highest summit on Earth, it was only a matter of time before people decided that Everest needed to be climbed. After the American explorer Robert Peary claimed to have reached the North Pole in 1909, and Roald Amundsen led a Norwegian party to the South Pole in 1911, Everest, the so-called Third Pole, became the most coveted object in the realm of terrestrial exploration. "Getting to the top," proclaimed Gunther O. Dierenfurth, an influential alpinist and chronicler of early Himalayan mountaineering, "was a matter of universal human endeavor, a cause from which there is no withdrawal, whatever losses it may demand." Those losses, as it turned out, would not be insignificant. Following Sikdar's discovery in 1852, it would require the lives of 24 men, the efforts of 15 expeditions, and the passage of 101 years before the summit of Everest would finally be attained. Among mountaineers and other connoisseurs of geologic form, Everest is not regarded as a particularly comely peak. Its proportions are too chunky, too broad of beam, too crudely hewn. But what Everest lacks in architectural grace, it makes up for with sheer, overwhelming mass. Demarcating the Nepal-Tibet border, towering more than 12,000 feet above the valleys at its base, Everest looms as a three-sided pyramid of gleaming ice and dark striated rock. The first 8 expeditions to Everest were British, all of which attempted the mountain from the northern, Tibetan side. Not so much because it presented the most obvious weakness in the peak's formidable defenses, but rather because in 1921 the Tibetan government opened its long-closed borders to foreigners, while Nepal remained resolutely off-limits. The first Everesters were obliged to trek 400 arduous miles from Darjeeling across the Tibetan plateau simply to reach the foot of the mountain. Their knowledge of the deadly effects of extreme altitude was scant, and their equipment was pathetically inadequate by modern standards. Yet in 1924, a member of the 3rd British Expedition, Edward Felix Norton, reached an elevation of 28,126 feet, just 900 feet below the summit, before being defeated by exhaustion and snowblindness. It was an astounding achievement that was probably not surpassed for 29 years. I say probably because of what transpired 4 days after Norton's summit assault. At first light on June 8th, two other members of the 1924 British team, George Lee Mallory and Andrew Irvin, departed the highest camp for the top. Mallory, whose name is inextricably linked to Everest, was the driving force behind the first 3 expeditions to the peak. While on a lantern slide lecture tour of the United States, it was he who so notoriously quipped, "Because it is there," when an irritating newspaper man demanded to know why he wanted to climb Everest. In 1924, Mallory was 38, a married schoolmaster with 3 young children. A product of upper-tier English society, he was also an aesthete and idealist with decidedly romantic sensibilities. His athletic grace, social charm, and striking physical beauty had made him a favorite of Lytton Strachey and the Bloomsbury crowd. While tent-bound high on Everest, Mallory and his companions would read aloud to one another from Hamlet and King Lear. As Mallory and Irvin struggled slowly toward the summit of Everest on June 8, 1924, mist billowed across the upper pyramid, preventing companions lower on the mountain from monitoring the two climbers' progress. At 12:50 p.m., the clouds parted momentarily, and teammate Noel O'Dell caught a brief but clear glimpse of Mallory and Irvin high on the peak, approximately 5 hours behind schedule, but moving deliberately and expeditiously toward the top. The two climbers failed to return to their tent that night, however, and neither Mallory nor Irvin was ever seen again. Whether one or both of them reached the summit before being swallowed by the mountain and into legend has been fiercely debated ever since. The balance of the evidence suggests not. Lacking tangible proof, they were not credited with the first ascent in any case. In 1949, after centuries of inaccessibility, Nepal opened its borders to the outside world, and a year later, the new communist regime in China closed Tibet to foreigners. Those who would climb Everest, therefore, shifted their attention to the south side of the peak. In the spring of 1953, a large British team, organized with the righteous zeal and overpowering resources of a military campaign, became the third expedition to attempt Everest from Nepal. On May 28th, following 2.5 months of prodigious effort, a high camp was dug tenuously into the southeast ridge at 27,900 feet. Early the following morning, Edmund Hillary, a rangy New Zealander, and Tenzing Norgay, a highly skilled Sherpa mountaineer, set out for the top breathing bottled oxygen. By 9 a.m., they were at the south summit, gazing across the dizzyingly narrow ridge that led to the summit proper. Another hour brought them to the foot of what Hillary described as the most formidable-looking problem on the ridge, a rock step some 40 feet high. The rock itself, smooth and almost holdless, might have been an interesting Sunday afternoon problem to a group of expert climbers in the Lake District, but here, it was a barrier beyond our feeble strength to overcome. With Tenzing nervously paying out rope from below, Hillary wedged himself into a cleft between the rock buttress and a fin of vertical snow at its edge, then began to inch his way up what would thereafter be known as the Hillary Step. The climbing was strenuous and sketchy, but Hillary persisted until, as he would later write, "I could finally reach over the top of the rock and drag myself out of the crack onto a wide ledge. For a few moments I lay regaining my breath, and for the first time really felt the fierce determination that nothing now could stop us reaching the top. I took a firm stance on the ledge and signaled to Tenzing to come on up. As I heaved hard on the rope, Tenzing wriggled his way up the crack and finally collapsed exhausted at the top, like a giant fish when it has just been hauled from the sea after a terrible struggle." Fighting exhaustion, the two climbers continued up the undulating ridge above. Hillary wondered, rather dully, whether we would have enough strength left to get through. I cut around the back of another hump and saw that the ridge ahead dropped away and we could see far into Tibet. I looked up, and there above us was a rounded snow cone. A few whacks of the ice axe, a few cautious steps, and Tenzing and I were on top. And thus, shortly before noon on May 29th, 1953, did Hillary and Tenzing become the first men to stand atop Mount Everest. 3 days later, word of the ascent reached Queen Elizabeth on the eve of her coronation, and the Times of London broke the news on the morning of June 2nd in its early edition. The dispatch had been filed from Everest via a coded radio message, to prevent competitors from scooping the Times, by a young correspondent named James Morris, who 20 years later, having earned considerable esteem as a writer, would famously change his gender to female and his Christian name to Jan. As Morris wrote 4 decades after the momentous climb in Coronation Everest, The First Ascent and the Scoop That Crowned the Queen, "It is hard to imagine now the almost mystical delight with which the coincidence of the two happenings, the coronation and the Everest ascent, was greeted in Britain. Emerging at last from the austerity which had plagued them since the Second World War, but at the same time facing the loss of their great empire and the inevitable decline of their power in the world, the British had half convinced themselves that the accession of the young queen was a token of a fresh start, a new Elizabethan age, as the newspapers like to call it. Coronation Day, June 2, 1953, was to be a day of symbolical hope and rejoicing, in which all the British patriotic loyalties would find a supreme moment of expression. And marvel of marvels, on that very day, there arrived the news from distant places, from the frontiers of the old empire, in fact, that a British team of mountaineers had reached the supreme remaining earthly objective of exploration and adventure, the top of the world. The moment aroused a whole orchestra of rich emotions among the British: pride, patriotism, nostalgia for the lost past of the war and derring do, hope for a rejuvenated future. people of a certain age remember vividly to this day the moment when, as they waited on a drizzly June morning for the coronation procession to pass by in London, they heard the magical news that the summit of the world was, so to speak, theirs. Tenzing became a national hero throughout India, Nepal, and Tibet, each of which claimed him as one of their own. Knighted by the Queen, Sir Edmund Hillary saw his image reproduced on postage stamps, comic strips, books, movies, magazine covers. Overnight, the hatchet-faced beekeeper from Auckland had been transformed into one of the most famous men on earth. Hillary and Tenzing climbed Everest a month before I was conceived, so I didn't share in the collective sense of pride and wonder that swept the world, an event that an older friend says was comparable in its visceral impact to the first manned landing on the moon. A decade later, however, a subsequent ascent of the mountain helped establish the trajectory of my life. On May 22, 1963, Tom Hornbein, a 32-year-old doctor from Missouri, and Willie Unsold, 36, a professor of theology from Oregon, reached the summit of Everest via the peak's daunting West Ridge, previously unclimbed. By then, the summit had already been achieved on 4 occasions, by 11 men. But the West Ridge was considerably more difficult than either of the 2 previously established routes, the South Col and Southeast Ridge, or the North Col and Northeast Ridge. Hornbein's and Unsold's ascent was, and continues to be, deservedly hailed as one of the great feats in the annals of mountaineering. Late in the day on their summit push, the 2 Americans climbed a stratum of steep, crumbly rock, the infamous Yellow Band. Surmounting this cliff demanded tremendous strength and skill. Nothing so technically challenging had ever been climbed at such extreme altitude. Once on top of the Yellow Band, Hornbein and Unsold doubted they could safely descend it. Their best hope for getting off the mountain alive, they concluded, was to go over the top and down the well-established Southeast Ridge route, an extremely audacious plan, given the late hour, the unknown terrain, and their rapidly diminishing supply of bottled oxygen. Hornbein and Unsold arrived on the summit at 6:15 p.m., just as the sun was setting, and were forced to spend the night in the open above 28,000 feet. At the time, the highest bivouac in history. It was a cold night, but mercifully without wind. Although Unsold's toes froze and would later be amputated, both men survived to tell their tale. I was 9 years old at the time, and living in Corvallis, Oregon, where Unsold also made his home. He was a close friend of my father's, and I sometimes played with the oldest Unsold children, Regan, who was a year older than me, and Devi, a year younger. A few months before Willie Unsold departed for Nepal, I reached the summit of my first mountain, an unspectacular 9,000-foot volcano in the Cascade Range that now sports a chairlift to the top, in the company of my dad, Willie, and Regan. Not surprisingly, accounts of the 1963 epic on Everest resonated loud and long in my pre-adolescent imagination. While my friends idolized John Glenn, Sandy Koufax, and Johnny Unitas, my own heroes were Hornbein and Unsold. Secretly, I dreamed of ascending Everest myself one day. For more than a decade, it remained a burning ambition. By the time I was in my early 20s, climbing had become the focus of my existence to the exclusion of almost everything else. Achieving the summit of a mountain was tangible, immutable, concrete. The incumbent hazards lent the activity a seriousness of purpose that was sorely missing from the rest of my life. I thrilled in the fresh perspective that came from tipping the ordinary plane of existence on end. And climbing provided a sense of community as well. To become a climber was to join a self-contained, rabidly idealistic society, largely unnoticed and surprisingly uncorrupted by the world at large. The culture of ascent was characterized by intense competition and undiluted machismo. But for the most part, its constituents were concerned with impressing only one another. Getting to the top of any given mountain was considered much less important than how one got there. Prestige was earned by tackling the most unforgiving routes with minimal equipment, in the boldest style imaginable. Nobody was admired more than so-called free soloists, visionaries who ascended alone, without rope or hardware. In those years, I lived to climb, existing on $5,000 or $6,000 a year, working as a carpenter and a commercial salmon fisherman just long enough to fund the next trip to the Bugaboos, or Tetons, or Alaska Range. But at some point, in my mid-twenties, I abandoned my boyhood fantasy of climbing Everest. By then, it had become fashionable among alpine cognoscenti to denigrate Everest as a slag heap, a peak lacking sufficient technical challenges or aesthetic appeal to be a worthy objective for a serious climber, which I desperately aspired to be. I began to look down my nose at the world's highest mountain. Such snobbery was rooted in the fact that by the early 1980s, Everest's easiest line, via South Col and the Southeast Ridge, had been climbed more than 100 times. My cohorts and I referred to the Southeast Ridge as the Yak Route. Our contempt was only reinforced in 1985 when Dick Bass, a wealthy 55-year-old Texan with limited climbing experience, was ushered to the top of Everest by an extraordinary young climber named David Brashears, an event that was accompanied by a blizzard of uncritical media attention. Previously, Everest had by and large been the province of elite mountaineers. In the words of Michael Kennedy, the editor of Climbing Magazine, "To be invited on an Everest expedition was an honor earned only after you served a long apprenticeship on lower peaks, and to actually reach the summit elevated a climber to the upper firmament of mountaineering stardom." Bass's ascent changed all that. In bagging Everest, he became the first person to climb all of the 7 summits, a feat that brought him worldwide renown, spurred a swarm of other weekend climbers to follow in his guided boot prints, and rudely pulled Everest into the postmodern era. Note: the highest peaks on each of the 7 continents are Everest, 29,028 feet, Asia; Aconcagua, 22,834 feet, South America; McKinley, also known as Denali, 20,320 feet, North America; Kilimanjaro, 19,340 feet, Africa; Elbrus, 18,510 feet, Europe; Vinson Massif, 16,067 feet, Antarctica; Kosciuszko, 7,316 feet, Australia. After Dick Bass climbed all 7, a Canadian climber named Patrick Morrow argued that because the highest point in Oceania, the group of lands that includes Australia, is not Kosciuszko, but rather the much more difficult summit of Karstens Pyramid, 16,535 feet, in the Indonesian province of Irian Barat, Bass wasn't the first to bag the 7 summits. He, Morrow, was. More than one critic of the 7 summits concept has pointed out that a considerably more difficult challenge than ascending the highest peak on each continent would be to climb the 2nd highest peak on each continent, a couple of which happen to be very demanding climbs. End of note. To aging Walter Mitty types like myself, Dick Bass was an inspiration, Seaborn Beck Weathers explained in a thick East Texas twang during the trek to Everest Base Camp last April. A 49-year-old Dallas pathologist, Beck was one of 8 clients on Rob Hall's 1996 guided expedition. Bass showed that Everest was within the realm of possibility for regular guys. "Assuming you're reasonably fit and have some disposable income, I think the biggest obstacle is probably taking time off from your job and leaving your family for 2 months." For a great many climbers, the record shows, stealing time away from the daily grind has not been an insurmountable obstacle, nor has the hefty outlay of cash. Over the past half decade, the traffic on all of the 7 summits, but especially Everest, has multiplied at an astonishing rate. And to meet the demand, the number of commercial enterprises peddling guided ascents of the 7 summits, especially Everest, has multiplied correspondingly. In the spring of 1996, 30 distinct expeditions were on the flanks of Everest, at least 10 of them organized as money-making ventures. The government of Nepal recognized that the throngs flocking to Everest created serious problems in terms of safety, aesthetics, and impact to the environment. While grappling with the issue, Nepalese ministers came up with a solution that seemed to hold the dual promise of limiting the crowds while increasing the flow of hard currency into the impoverished national coffers. Raise the fee for climbing permits. In 1991, the Ministry of Tourism charged $2,300 for a permit that allowed a team of any size to attempt Everest. In 1992, the fee was increased to $10,000 for a team of up to 9 climbers, with another $1,200 to be paid for each additional climber. But climbers continued to swarm to Everest, despite the higher fees. In the spring of 1993, on the 40th anniversary of the first ascent, a record 15 expeditions, comprising 294 climbers, attempted to scale the peak from the Nepalese side. That autumn, the ministry raised the permit fee yet again, to a staggering $50,000 for as many as 5 climbers, plus $10,000 for each additional climber, up to a maximum of 7. Additionally, the government decreed that no more than 4 expeditions would be allowed on the Nepalese flanks each season. What the Nepalese ministers didn't take into consideration, however, was that China charged only $15,000 to allow a team of any size to climb the mountain from Tibet and placed no limit on the number of expeditions each season. The flood of Everesters therefore shifted from Nepal to Tibet, leaving hundreds of Sherpas out of work. The ensuing hue and cry persuaded Nepal, in the spring of 1996, to abruptly cancel the 4 expedition limit. And while they were at it, the government ministers jacked up the permit fee once again, this time to $70,000 for up to 7 climbers, plus another $10,000 for each additional climber. Judging from the fact that 16 of the 30 expeditions on Everest last spring were climbing on the Nepalese side of the mountain, the high cost of obtaining a permit doesn't seem to have been a significant deterrent. Even before the calamitous outcome of the 1996 pre-monsoon climbing season, the proliferation of commercial expeditions over the past decade was a touchy issue. Traditionalists were offended that the world's highest summit was being sold to rich parvenus, some of who, if denied the services of guides, would probably have difficulty making it to the top of a peak as modest as Mount Rainier. Everest, the purists sniffed, had been debased and profaned. Such critics also pointed out that, thanks to the commercialization of Everest, the once hallowed peak has now even been dragged into the swamp of American jurisprudence. Having paid princely sums to be escorted up Everest, some climbers have then sued their guides when the summit eluded them. "Occasionally you'll get a client who thinks he's bought a guaranteed ticket to the summit," laments Peter Athens, a highly respected guide who's made 11 trips to Everest and reached the top 4 times. "Some people don't understand that an Everest expedition can't be run like a Swiss train." Sadly, not every Everest lawsuit is unwarranted. Inept or disreputable companies have on more than one occasion failed to deliver crucial logistical support. Oxygen, for instance, as promised. On some expeditions, guides have gone to the summit without any of their paying customers, prompting the bitter clients to conclude that they were brought along simply to pick up the tab. In 1995, the leader of a commercial expedition absconded with tens of thousands of dollars of his client's money before the trip even got off the ground. In March 1995, I received a call from an editor at Outside Magazine proposing that I join a guided Everest expedition scheduled to depart 5 days hence and write an article about the mushrooming commercialization of the mountain and the attendant controversies. The magazine's intent was not that I climb the peak. The editors simply wanted me to remain in base camp and report the story from the East Rongbuk Glacier at the foot of the Tibetan side of the mountain. I considered the offer seriously. I went so far as to book a flight and get the required immunizations, and then bowed out at the last minute. Given the disdain I'd expressed for Everest over the years, one might reasonably assume that I declined to go on principle. In truth, the call from outside had unexpectedly aroused a powerful, long-buried desire. I said no to the assignment only because I thought it would be unbearably frustrating to spend 2 months in the shadow of Everest without ascending higher than base camp. If I were going to travel to the far side of the globe and spend 8 weeks away from my wife and home, I wanted an opportunity to climb the mountain. I asked Mark Bryant, the editor of Outside, if he would consider postponing the assignment for 12 months, which would give me time to train properly for the physical demands of the expedition. I also inquired if the magazine would be willing to book me with one of the more reputable guide services and cover the $65,000 fee, thus giving me a shot at actually reaching the summit. I didn't really expect him to say yes to this plan. I'd written more than 60 pieces for Outside over the previous 15 years, and seldom had the travel budget for any of these assignments exceeded $2,000 or $3,000. Bryant called back a day later after conferring with Outside's publisher. He said that the magazine wasn't prepared to shell out $65,000, but that he and the other editors thought the commercialization of Everest was an important story. If I was serious about trying to climb the mountain, he insisted, Outside would figure out a way to make it happen. During the 33 years I'd called myself a climber, I'd undertaken some difficult projects. In Alaska, I'd put up a hairy new route on the Moose's Tooth and pulled off a solo ascent of the Devil's Thumb that involved spending 3 weeks alone on a remote ice cap. I'd done a number of fairly extreme ice climbs in Canada and Colorado. Near the southern tip of South America, where the wind sweeps the land like the broom of God, La Escoba de Dios, as the locals say, I'd scaled a frightening mile-high spike of vertical and overhanging granite called Cerro Torre, buffeted by 100-knot winds, plastered with frangible atmospheric rime. It was once, though no longer, thought to be the world's hardest mountain. But these escapades had occurred years earlier, in some cases decades earlier, when I was in my 20s and 30s. I was 41 now, well past my climbing prime, with a graying beard, bad gums, and 15 extra pounds around my midriff. I was married to a woman I loved fiercely, and who loved me back. Having stumbled upon a tolerable career, for the first time in my life I was actually living above the poverty line. My hunger to climb had been blunted, in short, by a bunch of small satisfactions that added up to something like happiness. None of the climbs I'd done in the past, moreover, had taken me to even moderately high altitude. Truth be told, I'd never been higher than 17,200 feet. Not even as high as Everest Base Camp. As an avid student of mountaineering history, I knew that Everest had killed more than 130 people since the British first visited the mountain in 1921, approximately one death for every four climbers who'd reached the summit, and that many of those who died had been far stronger and possessed vastly more high-altitude experience than I. But boyhood dreams die hard, I discovered, and good sense be damned. In late February 1996, Bryant called to say that there was a place waiting for me on Rob Hall's upcoming Everest expedition. When he asked if I was sure I wanted to go through with this, I said yes without even pausing to catch my breath. Chapter 3. Over Northern India, March 29, 1996, 30,000 feet. Speaking abruptly, I gave them a parable. I said, "It's the planet Neptune I'm talking about, just plain ordinary Neptune, not paradise, because I don't happen to know about paradise. So you see, this means you, nothing more, just you. Now there happens to be a big spot of rock," I said, "up there, and I must warn you that people are pretty stupid up in Neptune, chiefly because they each lived tied up in their own string. And some of them, whom I had wanted to mention in particular, some of them had got themselves absolutely determined about that mountain. You wouldn't believe it," I said. "Life or death, use or no use, these people had got the habit, and they now spent their spare time and all their energies in chasing the clouds of their own glory up and down all the steepest faces in the district. And one and all they came back uplifted. And well they might, I said, for it was amusing that even in Neptune, most of them made shift to chase themselves pretty safely up the easier faces. But anyhow, there was uplift, and indeed it was observable, both in the resolute set of their faces and in the gratification that shone in their eyes. And as I had pointed out, this was in Neptune, not Paradise, where, it may be, there perhaps is nothing else to be done. John Menlove Edwards, Letter from a Man. 2 hours into Thai Air Flight 311 from Bangkok to Kathmandu, I left my seat and walked to the rear of the airplane. Near the bank of lavatories on the starboard side, I crouched to peer through a small waist-level window, hoping to catch a glimpse of some mountains. I was not disappointed. There, raking the horizon, stood the jagged incisors of the Himalaya. I stayed at the window for the rest of the flight, spellbound, hunkered over a trash bag full of empty soda cans and half-eaten meals, my face pressed against the cold plexiglass. Immediately I recognized the huge, sprawling bulk of Kanchenjunga. At 28,169 feet above sea level, the third highest mountain on Earth. 15 minutes later, Makalu, the world's fifth highest peak, came into view, and then, finally, the unmistakable profile of Everest itself. The ink-black wedge of the summit pyramid stood out in stark relief, towering over the surrounding ridges. Thrust high into the jet stream, the mountain ripped a visible gash in the 120-knot hurricane, sending forth a plume of ice crystals that trailed to the east like a long silk scarf. As I gazed across the sky at this contrail, it occurred to me that the top of Everest was precisely the same height as the pressurized jet bearing me through the heavens, that I proposed to climb to the cruising altitude of an Airbus 300 jetliner struck me, at that moment, as preposterous or worse. My palms felt clammy. 40 minutes later, I was on the ground in Kathmandu. As I walked into the airport lobby after clearing customs, a big-boned, clean-shaven young man took note of my two huge duffels and approached. "Would you be John, then?" he inquired in a lilting New Zealand accent, glancing at a sheet of photocopied passport photos depicting Rob Hall's clients. He shook my hand and introduced himself as Andy Harris, one of Hall's guides, come to deliver me to our hotel. Harris, who was 31, said there was supposed to be another client arriving on the same flight from Bangkok, a 53-year-old attorney from Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, named Lou Kosicki. It ended up taking an hour for Kosicki to locate his bags, so while we waited, Andy and I compared notes on some hard climbs we'd both survived in Western Canada and discussed the merits of skiing versus snowboarding. Andy's palpable hunger for climbing, his unalloyed enthusiasm for the mountains, made me wistful for the period in my own life when climbing was the most important thing imaginable, when I charted the course of my existence in terms of mountains I'd ascended and those I hoped one day to ascend. Just before Kosicki, a tall, athletic, silver-haired man with patrician reserve, emerged from the airport customs queue, I asked Andy how many times he'd been on Everest. "Actually," he confessed cheerfully, "this will be my first time, same as you. Should be interesting to see how I do up there." Hall had booked us at the Garuda Hotel, a friendly, funky establishment in the heart of Tamil, Kathmandu's frenetic tourist district, on a narrow avenue choked with cycle rickshaws and street hustlers. Long popular with expeditions bound for the Himalaya, the Garuda's walls were covered with signed photographs of famous alpinists who'd slept there over the years, Reinhold Messner, Peter Hobler, Kitty Calhoun, John Roskelly, Jeff Lowe. Ascending the stairs to my room, I passed a large four-color poster titled Himalayan Trilogy, depicting Everest, K2, and Lhotse, the planet's highest, second-highest, and fourth-highest mountains, respectively. Superimposed against the images of these peaks, the poster showed a grinning, bearded man in full alpine regalia. A caption identified this climber as Rob Hall. The poster, intended to drum up business for Hall's guiding company, Adventure Consultants, commemorated his rather impressive feat of ascending all three peaks during 2 months in 1994. An hour later, I met Hall in the flesh. He stood 6 foot 3 or 4 and was skinny as a pole. There was something cherubic about his face, yet he looked older than his 35 years. Perhaps it was the sharply etched creases at the corners of his eyes, or the air of authority he projected. He was dressed in a Hawaiian shirt and faded Levi's, patched on one knee with an embroidered yin-yang symbol. An unruly thatch of brown hair corkscrewed across his forehead.